So, in the late 1800s, a poet named William Henley wrote a poem that was known in literature, but was only picked up in latter years as the name of a TV show or a movie, Invictus. It was used to describe Mandela and the South African rugby team captains joining together for a momentous rugby game and changing history. Here's what it says. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but not bowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. It's a wonderful poem about the resilience of the human soul. He wrote that having had his left leg amputated, fell from a train carriage, and that sparked tuberculosis in him, and he died early in life, really, in his 50s. But it was in the middle of that that he wrote this poem, and it's a wonderful poem about the resilience of the human soul, about the strength of humankind. It also hides a great darkness. As we look at these chapters in Romans, we're going to be sort of peeling away some things that we have pretty much assumed philosophically as well as theologically that basically are in tune with that poem, that it sort of sounds right to us that we are the captains of our fate, that we're the masters of our destiny. And theologians and philosophers have argued for centuries about the nature of human choice. Who's in charge? Is there such a thing as free will? Or has everything been prescribed somehow from above or behind and that sort of thing? So Paul goes right at this topic as a brilliant legal mind and a brilliant theologian. He comes at us and tries to have us understand our true nature. He has spent like a long time, many chapters, establishing the fact that there is a problem in the world and that God has done something about that problem and is kind of captured in the notion of grace. And then he moves into a so what kind of section and says, so since that has happened, what's different about us? What's different about our world? Do we have Sungle up here? Here it is. So in Romans chapter 6, Paul, having kind of worked out this whole wonderful matter of God's grace, which he is proposing is the solution to everything that is wrong from chapters 1 through 5. And he has brought us to our knees, really, concluding that there is nothing good about us. There's a terrible section in these early chapters of Romans that actually quotes the Psalms, and it characterizes God as having come down to find out if there's anybody who's good, if there's anyone who does what's good. And God's conclusion is there's not a single one. And that leads us to this doctrine that we call total depravity. That what God says is that you've got nothing. Like, you come to the table with nothing. In fact, you come to the table with a list of debts. And it's only because of the grace of God that that can be remedied. And having exposed God's great grace, he then comes to two rhetorical sort of questions and says, so then, the first question he asks is, should we keep on sinning so that grace may increase? And Andrew talked to us about that last week. And it's like Paul sets up a straw man. He imagines somebody in the back of the room saying, so if grace is such a wonderful thing and sin makes it necessary, let's keep on sinning. And then Paul has this answer. My favorite two little Greek words there, meganoita. It's like, not on your life. Are you an idiot? That's nonsense. Why are you even thinking that? And we feel like saying, well, you brought it up. We didn't. But anyway, he says, no. That's not the point at all. Yes, indeed, grace can cover sins, but it has not brought us to the point of saying, so we can be careless about this. We might as well keep on sinning, and every time we do, there'll be grace to cover it. No worries. But then, later on, he asks another question, and it is this one. What then should we keep on sinning because we're not under the law but under grace? And that's a different question. He's basically saying, you may be thinking that now that the law has been superseded by grace, you don't need to live that way anymore. You don't need to even go back and, you know, examine verse by verse and hear what the commandments were, the Decalogue, and all the different aspects of God's law. Should we also throw that stuff away and say, we don't even have to worry about keeping the law anymore? We'll just keep on sinning. And once again, Paul says, nah, meganoita, not on your life, not at all. So that brings us to the, then what do we do with reference to our sin? And that's the second half of Romans 6 here. And I felt like we need to come back to a very fundamental question. And that question is, what is sin? And it's one of those things where you might immediately think, okay, I think I know what that is. But when we begin to understand the theology of sin in the Bible, it's not so much like a children's storybook version of sin where it's doing bad things. Sin is not only doing bad things, but sin, I'd like to show you, is actually the human declaration of independence. From the very beginning, the character of sin was a declaration of independence. That's where Invictus is a bit dark. It's really those last two lines of the poem are what we said when we began to understand that God was interested in how we would live our lives, and it might be different from the way we think we ought to live our lives. So when we say those two last lines, it's like God says, wait a minute, where did you get that idea that you are in charge of your life? Now here in the West, we do not like to be told what to do. We have independent spirits. The country south of us is basically founded on the fact that individuals have rights and opportunities that are, you can't resist them. And we resist anybody saying to us, you shouldn't do that, or you shouldn't think that, or you should this. We say, no, you can't tell me what to do. Well, sin is actually that attitude of saying, nobody tells me what to do. And that's what we said to God from the very beginning. You can't tell us what to do. So God set up a scenario and said, okay, you can do all of these things, but you can't do this one thing. And what did we say? Yes, we can. And the serpent coming to Eve in the garden said, did God really say that? And that was the seed of sin that she said, well, I don't know. And she looked at this beautiful tree, and it was gorgeous, and she tasted the fruit. It was wonderful, and she's going like, yeah, maybe God doesn't really know what he's talking about. Maybe somehow or other, he's on the wrong side of this, and we can't do whatever we want to do. So that has issued into, you know, the finite aspects of sin that are moral failures and ethical failures and all of the rest. But far bigger than just doing things or not doing things, the whole attitude of humanity towards God is sinful. And it works out in a couple of directions. The one is that we say, don't you worry, God, we can take care of things. And especially these days when we find ourselves sitting around a fire or whatever, complaining about the government and the state of the world, the one thing we don't often come back to is to say the problem is sin, right? It's not just that we can't do the things that need to be done. It's sin that we are actually, we have this propensity to try to do things and say to God, we won't do it your way. So the idea of going public and saying we as a nation need to confess our sin would be ridiculous, right? Because we don't believe in sin anymore, except we do maybe give a nod to that little Sunday school, sinning is telling lies. Well, sin is far bigger than telling lies. It's far bigger than stealing. It is the whole attitude of humanity where we say we are in charge of our lives. We are in charge of our destiny. And we wonder how many more disasters do we have in our world, in our human family, before we finally say there's an elephant in the room. It's sin. So go ahead and try to bring up sin in the lunchroom tomorrow or the classroom, and it'll be, that's just a ridiculous notion. Like, we're way past that. But as we go past that, we do acknowledge that we as a society are riddled through with problems, but we can't use the word sin to address those things. There's a book by a psychiatrist called Scott Peck, who it's called People of the Lie. And as a psychiatrist, he said there were many, many cases where he was not able to close the case in terms of being able to diagnose something or describe something, because he said the word evil was not allowed in his vocabulary. But the only way to describe those situations, those people, he would say, is they're evil. But we as a brave society are saying that we can't use that word. That's not our problem. We can fix our world. If we have the right politics, if we have the right economics, if we have all the right things, we can fix it. That's a sinful attitude. So sin is, before we think of it actually being something where we do what we shouldn't do, it's the whole attitude that we carry of saying, we can do this, of saying to God, you're not needed here, please. We'll take the nice things from you. We'll think about how wonderful and glorious you are, and we'll worship you. But don't ever mess with our lives. Like, don't tell us what to do. We are the masters of our fate. So the first area in which our sin is demonstrated is that we miss the mark. We can't do what needs to be done. And the second is that we just overstep boundaries. And that's where our morality, our ethics fill in, and we say, actually, we go beyond where we're allowed to go, and that's sin. So those two things collect to describe this whole independence movement of humankind that began in the garden and has gone on ever since, and has left us in the place where we're not allowed to say what the problem is, even though it explains everything that is broken and failing around us. So here's what Paul says about this matter of being free from the law. And I love how Peterson sort of describes it. He says, so since we're out from under the old tyranny, does that mean we can live any old way we want? Since we're free in the freedom of God, can we do anything that comes to mind? Hardly. That's Peterson's English translation of meganoita. It's far stronger than hardly. It's like, not on your life. That is a ridiculous notion. He says, you know well enough from your own experience that there are some acts of so-called freedom that destroy freedom. Offer yourselves to sin, for instance, and it's your last free act. But offer yourself to the ways of God, and the freedom never quits. All your lives you've let sin tell you what to do, but thank God you started listening to a new master, one whose commands set you free to live openly in his freedom. So because the shackles of the law have been taken off, does that mean we can just do whatever we want to do? And Paul says, no. Note this, that so-called freedom is false freedom. And I think that's where it has been an elusive idea for us, where we think that, and our go-to answer is that, of course we are free. Of course we can do whatever we want. Of course we can determine our lives. We can describe our destinies. We can move towards our goals. We can do it. And Paul says, yeah, but there's a problem, because this so-called freedom of yours, how's that worked out for you? Because if you offer yourself in this one way, there goes your freedom. He says, offer yourself to sin, for instance, and it's your last free act. So we are not morally free beings. The very first time we give ourselves to sin, we have no more freedom. And there's a wonderful irony, because Paul says, but when you offer yourself to the ways of God, the freedom never ends. So we sit with that and think, what does that mean? Well, we know what it means to be caught in sins. We know what it is to be caught by temptation. We know how it inevitably takes us down wrong paths. And yet we're able to go back and discern in our lives when we have actively submitted to God in some way or another. There's an incredible freedom that comes along. So Paul is chipping away at the notion that freedom is up to us. And he says, the last act of freedom, actually, that you will ever have is when you choose to sin, because then you're done. You're caught. He goes on and says, so I'm using this freedom language because it's easy to picture. You can readily recall, can't you, how at one time, the more you did just what you felt like doing, not caring about others, not caring about God, the worse your life became and the less freedom you had. And how much different it is now as you live in God's freedom, your lives healed and expansive in holiness. To be free is what? To do whatever you want? No. To be free is actually to submit to true freedom, which is to be governed by your proper master. He says, as long as you did what you felt like doing, ignoring God, you didn't have to bother with right thinking or right living or right anything for that matter. But do you call that a free life? What did you get out of it? Nothing you're proud of now. Where did it get you? A dead end. So that's the language of the death living that comes because of the delusion that you can do what you want and you're able to do whatever you aspire to do, even in your own definitions of good things to aspire to. Anytime you succumb to this idea that you're able to do things and you're able to do things that you shouldn't do, you're done. Because, like one of the quotes says, you got to serve somebody. And if we think that we're free to do whatever we want, we actually are giving in to a master that is a deadly master, who is going to take us down the wrong path and who is going to lead us to a death kind of living that is no living at all. Now he says that you found out you don't have to listen to sin telling you what to do and have discovered the delight of listening to God telling you. What a surprise. A whole, healed, put-together life right now with more and more of life on the way. Work hard for sin your whole life and your pension is death. But God's gift is real life, eternal life, delivered by Jesus our Master. So we find ourselves, we find a resonance with what he's saying, that when we expand our notion of what sin is and say it's trying to do what we can't do and then actually doing what we know we shouldn't do, it just inevitably leads us down this path of one more, and we as a society find ourselves throwing our hands up because we say, what can be done? We've tried everything, and there's no God who's going to help us do that. We've tried to do it, and we'll try again. We'll maybe try a different thing, a different way. And Paul would say, well, how far has that gotten you? It has actually led you into more and more of a bondage. And when it comes to your actual personal, moral, and ethical freedom, every time you give in, you are submitting to a master who is going to take you to one end and one end only, and that is the end of death. It's death living. Whereas, he says, if you are discovering life in God, you're discovering that life to the opposite of this death living is actually life living, and it reminds us of what Jesus said, that he's going to give us life everlasting, like life eternal, like abundant life. That comes in the same way that giving ourselves to the sinful nature that we have leads us down and down and down. Submitting to God leads us up and up and up, and it's a wonderful process to look back and say, the time I discovered that I needed to listen to God was the time that I began to know real victory in my life, real success in my life, in terms of being part of the change, of the new creation of which I am part. We, when our kids were small, enjoyed going to the Oregon coast in western United States. And there's a place called Cannon Beach. And we, one summer, we got a cabin there or something, and we were, it's just beautiful and rugged and windy. And so the thing that people do in that part of the States is they fly kites. So we didn't have a kite, but it looked like fun, so we bought one. And we spent like a week learning how to fly our kite on the Oregon coast. And it was just a lot of fun, unless the kite plunged into the sea, which often happened, and then to try to drag it back out of the sea was just an enormous challenge. But I remember just noticing the beauty of the kites flying in the wind. And if you see kites flying, they look so free, don't they? And they look so glorious. So I imagined that I had a kite. And my kite was flying, soaring, enjoying the wind. But it looked back at the ground and saw me holding a string. And it said to itself, as kites do, who's this guy? Why does he get to hold my string? So there are seagulls around, and my kite convinces the seagulls to peck away at the string. Because my kite wants to fly wherever it wants to fly, not where I want it to fly. And to its utter dismay, when the seagulls cut the string, what happened to the kite? It crashed to the ground. Freedom was not to be out of someone else's control. Freedom was to have the right kite master. And the elusive truth for us is that freedom is not what we want. Freedom is not living into our best ideas and best ways. Freedom is to have the right kite master. And when we have the right kite master, then we will really know what freedom is. We will soar in the wind because Jesus, God, is our kite master. And we discover at the end of the day, the kite was never intended, never built to fly by itself. We were never created to be autonomous. We were never created to be independent. We were created to serve God. He has the right to claim ownership. He has the right to claim control in our lives. And Paul says, when you discover that, actually you'll discover the real genius of what you were created for, and it will be life and life-giving as you live into it. Why don't we pray about it? Father, thank you for the mind of Paul, who was sorting through the true state of humankind and the wonderful grace that you have delivered to us, and also the new creations that we now are, in which we discover what we were really intended for. Help us, Father, to divest ourselves of worldly, sinful notions that we are the captains of our fate. Help us to understand that we will be truly free when we have the right master to whom we give account as we live our lives and live into the glory of his freedom day by day by day. In Jesus' name.